session for Thursday, September 23rd, 2010. Will now come to order. Just as a preliminary matter, and out on the table where we put the blue documents, there was inadvertently a document that was put out there that don't relate to the advisory opinions that we have on the agenda today. And if you picked up one of those documents that was inadvertently released, if you could return that to the commission secretary's table where Lisa Chapman is sitting, that would be very much appreciated. First item on the agenda is the approval of minutes for August 26, 2010. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of agenda document 1056, the minutes from our meeting of August 26, 2010.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Next item on the agenda is the discussion of draft advisory opinion 2010-16, Emblem Health Services. We have a presentation from Cheryl Hemsley from the Office of General Counsel. Good morning, and please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, good morning to you. Before you, an agenda document 10-57 is draft advisory opinion 2010-16. The requester, Emblem Health LLC, is a limited liability company treated as a partnership for federal tax purposes and is equally owned by two member corporations, one of which has an SSF. Those two member corporations, in turn, are wholly owned by Emblem Health, Inc. Emblem Health LLC asked several questions concerning the relationships between itself and its corporate owners and what activities each may undertake on behalf of the SSF. The draft concludes that the LLC is per se affiliated with all three of the corporations in the structure presented, and accordingly, the LLC may function as a connected organization of the SSF, but may not be listed as such on the SSF's FEC Form 1. The SSF may be renamed for Emblem Health LLC. The corporate members of the LLC may also pay for the SSF's administrative and solicitation costs. And finally, the LLC and its corporate members may solicit contributions to the SSF from the restricted classes of the member corporations and from the executive and administrative personnel of the LLC. Mr. Chairman, if the Commission approves this draft, we would ask for authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes to the document. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Any discussion or questions for Council? If none, do we have a motion? Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of agenda document 1057, the draft advisory opinion in 2010-16 for Emblem Health Services Company, LLC, and Health Insurance Plans of Greater New York. And I would ask, included in my motion is to authorize the Council's office to make any technical and conforming changes.
Any discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Ms. Hemsley. Next item on the agenda is the discussion of draft advisory opinion 2010-17, Stutzman for Congress. Vice Chair, I understand we have a late submitted document.
We do, Mr. Chairman, and we have several, so I'll make a combined motion if that's acceptable. I move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda documents 1058, 1059, 1059A, 1059B, 1060, 1060A, 1060B, 1061, 1061A, and 1061B.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. We have a presentation from Joanna Waldstreicher from the Office of General Counsel, and good morning, and please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 1058 responds to an advisory opinion request submitted by counsel for Stutzman for Congress. The committee is the principal campaign committee for Marlon Stutzman, a candidate for the House of Representatives in Indiana's 3rd Congressional District. The request concerns a special election and a general election that are to be held on the same day and asks whether the committee may presumptively redesignate undesignated general election contributions to the special election. The draft concludes that the committee may treat undesignated contributions as contributions made either for the special election or for the general election or divided between them, as long as the contributions do not exceed the contributor's combined limit for both elections and that no redesignation is necessary. We received no comments on either the request or the draft.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Any discussion or questions for Council? If none, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of agenda document 1058, draft advisory opinion in 2010-17, Stutzman for Congress, and authorize Council to make technical and conforming changes.
All right. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next item on the agenda is the consideration of draft advisory opinion 2010-18, the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. We have with us Mark Elias and Jonathan Burkon on behalf of Requester, and please join us at the council's table. We have a presentation by Esther Hayden from the Office of General Counsel, and good morning, and when you're ready, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, Commissioners. Before you are agenda documents 10-59, 10-59A, and 10-59B, which respond to an advisory opinion request from the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. The DFL is a Minnesota State Party Committee affiliated with the National Democratic Party. After the 2008 election, the DFL raised and deposited over $2 million into its recount account to pay for a recount and election contest arising from the 2008 election. At the time of this request, the DFL has approximately $11,600 remaining in its recount account. The DFL's request concerns permissible uses for the remaining recount funds. Specifically, the DFL asks three questions. First, whether the DFL may transfer the remaining recount funds to its federal account to be used for the 2010 general election. Second, in the alternative, whether the DFL may request that donors to the recount account redesignate their donations as contributions to the federal account. And finally, whether any recount funds remaining in the recount account may be used to pay for recount activities arising from the 2010 elections. There are three alternative drafts before the Commission today. We received no comments on the advisory opinion request and one comment on the drafts. I'd be happy to address any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that presentation. Just at the outset, the most recent draft, 10-59-B, otherwise known as Draft C, did council get a copy of that?
We did. Thank you.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Any discussion? Any, first of all, questions for council or council for Requester, or any discussion amongst commissioners? Commissioner McGann.
Might as well kick it off. This is an interesting one for a lot of reasons. We're here because we're talking about money raised for recounts, which years ago the FEC said was recounts were sort of in connection with an election, but not really, which never made a lot of sense to me because, well, for recounts, that's counting votes that have already been cast. So I don't understand the thought that this is somehow a separate deal, but that was water under the bridge long ago, and no one can really seem to figure out what happened back in 1978 or 79 when the commission came up with this. And then there's been some more recent AOs, most recently the Franken AO, which was correctly decided based upon a prior AO, but if you were on a clean slate, the Franken AO is more in this la-la land of made-up kind of law. But that's where we are. And now the question is, given that the commission has said that the state party can raise money for recounts, I guess at the time you asked about one specific recount. Now the question is, all right, well, we didn't spend it all, or we have the other recounts, or what do we do now? Broadly defined question. And my view is you can do whatever you want with it, so long as you don't break through the real contribution limits, which is for actual campaign activity, which I think is draft B. And hopefully I have the right B. All this blue paper, right? It's easy to get confused. So I support draft B because, in my view, that is the way to go, because it does give life to the contribution limits, which really is the only thing we have to grab onto in all this, because the rest of this seems to be a creature of the commission, not through rulemaking, but AO and some rulemaking. I mean, I don't want to be too dismissive of the recent AOs. This is a rather ancient concept that has worked its way through, and the rationale for it is sort of lost now. But that being said, others, I think, want a more elaborate regime. And that's certainly, you know, reasonable people, I guess, can disagree on this. But for me, you raise money for a recount, you can spend it on recounts. And if you want to move it over to your regular account, I was going to say general account, but it's not a general account because campaigns have general accounts, party committees don't. I guess you could, so long as you don't double dip. You can't take money, you can't have people maxing out to the recount fund and then maxing out to your regular fund and say, well, that's not a violation of limits. That would be, for me, you could do that. You may want to, however, let the contributors know, not because the government's telling you, but because they have the biannual limit, and if you move from one to the other, the biannual limit all of a sudden is going to apply. I don't really have any questions other than one question. If we do go down this road of some sort of redesignation scheme, which of course is not based in the regs, the other drafts concede at the outset that the redesignation regs don't apply, but, well, maybe we'll apply them by analogy, which I found odd because those are really set up for campaigns with two bites at the apple, primary and general election, not party committees. How much of a cumbersome process would this be for your client? How much would it cost, that sort of thing, and having to move money around and go back to donors and all that? And I ask that because the commission has not had a lot of success with its current redesignation regime. Number of audits have come through before I joined the commission, since I've come through the commission, which frankly end up being a mess because people don't keep the letter and all that kind of thing. What's this going to cost your client? How tough is this for you to comply with as a practical matter?
Yeah, I think that you raise an important point. The state parties were thrust in this role as a result of the 2006-24 advisory opinion. The commission could have gone a different way, and at times various commissioners have expressed an interest in revisiting whether or not this ought to be the right direction, but this is the path that the commission traveled down, and it's thrust the state parties in a unique role, or not a unique role, but in an important role. And if you look at the dollars that were raised into the DFL as part of the recount, you can see it was a lot of activity. The commission has a lot of experience in the audit context and in the enforcement context with state parties and compliance, and I do worry that adding a what I guess I would refer to as a prudential requirement, which I think is what draft A would suggest, that is required but not statutorily or regulatorily, but I think becomes just another trap for state parties, and you know, another way that state parties, which are already underfunded and asked to do a lot in connection with federal elections and not in connection with federal elections in the case of recounts, potentially, a debate for another day. I think it adds another trap. It is yet another thing that state parties will have to manage and track. And I do think that if the commission were inclined to vote for draft A, it does need to reconcile candidly this idea of a federal account. I mean, the advisory opinion 2006-24 describes the recount account as a federal account. It does, in plain terms.
And that's campaign talk, not party talk.
Right. I mean, so if it is a federal account, it is hard to reconcile a required written redesignation requirement with the plain text of 300.2. I'm sorry, 300.30.
Let me keep the question I'm asking going, though, because I remember that when the commission put into place the best efforts regime, right, and you have to send out these letters, that was litigated, and the argument that those who sued the commission made was, this is going to cost a lot of money, send out these letters, stamps, postage, and all that kind of thing. And the commission went to court and said, no, it's really not that big a deal, limited. And the court said, okay. Of course, it seemed to have it's crept out from what the commission said in that court case it would be, but that's another topic. But it's similar in that this seems to me to require more staff, more headache, more bureaucracy, and I'm worried about, really, frankly, not your client here today, although I'm sure they're not flush with money. Very few state parties are. But what about a local party or maybe a third party? What about if a third party actually finds themselves, you know, it's the dog that was chasing the car, and all of a sudden the dog catches the car, and now they're in a recount? They're going to raise whatever money they can, right? And is this, I'm trying to get more of a sense, And I think some of the commissioners may want to get a sense of really how much of a headache this is, because it's easy to say, well, you guys redesignate all the time. This isn't a big deal. State parties don't. They just roll the money forward, and this is a kind of a new thing. But cost-wise, man-hours, anything you can sort of offer may
be helpful. I think you put your finger on it. I don't want to oversell what this will mean for the DFL, because the DFL is a very the DFL made a large commitment to this recount and engaged in it, and now has a relatively modest amount of money left, and obviously has lawyers here today trying to resolve this question. I do think, though, that for the vast majority of state and local parties, this will be, like I say, I can just, you know, I'm looking at this end of the dais, because I know that that's where it's going to come from. It's going to be in the audit context. It's going to be an auditor. I hope I'm pointing to the right end.
The empty chair.
The empty chair. I think it is not something, this is not going to be intuitive for state parties. It is not going to be intuitive that to move money from one federal account of a state party to another federal account of the same state party, that you need a redesignation. Because, in fact, moving money from federal accounts to federal accounts is something state parties do quite a bit of. They move money from national federal accounts to state party federal accounts, one state party federal account to another state party federal account, and this will be the exception to that rule. And, you know, some number of years from now, when the DFL, Franken, recount AO, and the whole recount situation is long in the rearview mirror, there is going to be some state party that will not have been aware that this was even an issue. They will have done it, and they will then face either a MER or an audit. And this commission will have laid an unusual trap for them, potentially. I'm not prejudging it what the vote will be, but will have laid an unusual trap for a state party, which is that they had to take money from it, what the commission described as a federal account, which is a federal reporting account, and nevertheless had to redesignate it from one account to the other.
And if you're a party and you want to comply with the law, I guess you don't wake up in the morning and say, gee, I better go search through advisory opinions for new sources of law, because you're going to pull this book off the shelf, and it's not in there.
It's not in there.
So
it's not in there, and
this is actually the Code of Federal Regulations, which has gotten quite heavy over the years. But that's just a...
I think it's not in there, and as I said, I actually think that there, if the commission is inclined to adopt draft A, I do think it needs to... And I say this respectfully to the drafters, I do think there needs to be some greater attentiveness. I assume the commission is not saying that federal transfers between federal accounts is no longer lawful, because that will be big news. That'll be something that he'll want to cover, because the RNC, the DNC, the national parties will want to know they can no longer transfer money between federal accounts. There is a way to read draft A that is in fact what you are saying, is that transfers between federal accounts are in fact not permissible. And I don't think that's what the commission meant, and I don't want to set up a straw man. I think whether it's fixable or not, I'll leave to you all, but I do think that there is a, if you don't mean that this is a federal, if you don't mean that the recount account is a federal account, then that's something to confront head on. If it is a federal account, then I think you run straight into the regulations as they are, which don't seem to require redesignation.
Further discussion or questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Go ahead, prejudge. You know where we're going on this. We started out with a couple of drafts because there were a couple of different perspectives, and neither one of them had four votes. And I think where we're going to end up is on draft C. I think that's the most recent edition, the revised edition, which actually... gets you pretty far to where you want to go. It's good of you to provide alternatives. You're a good lawyer. It's good to have a fallback position. Well, if we can't do this, can we do that? Some of us think that the transfers are precluded under the regulations in the Green Book. And I understand your argument, and it's actually kind of an appealing argument I think if we didn't have a regulation that appears to some of us to preclude, this is not a question, by the way, I'm just explaining, if we didn't have a regulation on the books that appears to preclude the transfer, then, and we were writing truly on a blank slate, then I think it's a very appealing argument that these are federally permissible funds and you're going to move them and you're going to make sure nobody's busting their contribution limits. You know, if that were the case, I would probably be inclined to say yes to the transfer. Unfortunately, I think there is another regulation that bars it. And you know, you're in here asking about your $11,000, but what we're creating here, as I know you're well aware, is a regime that's going to end up with a lot of money flowing, because we're sort of blessing the notion of these perpetual recount funds, and which is fine, and but people are going to raise a lot of money into them because it's like, oh great, now we got, you know, we allowed this other pot of money to be raised subject to the limit a few years ago. I think that was the right choice. I supported it, but now we're going to see these large pots of money accumulating, so the stakes are actually much higher than your $11,000. And I think you know that, and if we were only talking about your $11,000, I'm not sure that it would even be worth your billable hourly rate to be here today. But I think that everybody agrees that, you know, as you suggested, if you go through the redesignation process, that would be permissible. And everyone agrees that you can have these perpetual accounts, these recount funds that you can use for later recounts. They're not restricted to, you know, just this one recount and then the money kind of, what do you do with the money? You have to, like, give it back or it evaporates or something. So I think this is, the Commission has been actually fairly accommodating of your recount requests over the years, including this one. And this one will get you, as I said, fairly far along the way to where you need to go, or where you, I don't know if you need to go, but where you want to go, and where I'm sure others will follow. And we can only hope that they are equally well advised when they do so.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't going to raise this, but I really feel I have to, because it's a frustrating point for me, and it's probably a frustrating point for people who ask for AOs. When Commissioner Weintraub said you came out of the gate saying you know where we are, well, you don't. That's why he asked for an advisory opinion. And when we do advisory opinions, we're supposed to deliberate these in an open meeting. The APA, I think, requires it. I think our regs require it. I haven't actually found that page of the regs lately on AOs, but I think the whole point is the Commission's supposed to deliberate in public. And when we come in here and it seems like there's already a consensus draft that's been drafted, when did all this happen? This is not being done in public. And I really, since joining the Commission, have really been amazed at how much goes on behind closed doors, and there certainly has to be informal discussion among commissioners, and I think there's been quite a bit of that in many areas that I think has been for the good, and I certainly don't want to rain on that parade, but there comes a point where I feel like I come in here, I ask questions, I'm actually curious to know what folks think, I read the comments, and whether there should be a redesignation regime here or not really isn't the point. I mean, I guess it could go either way. I mean, it's not in the regs, but certainly if you do it, there's enough votes, I take it, that you're going to have the protection of an advisory opinion, which maybe that's really all we're here to do is get you some guidance and go home. But it's troubling when it seems like it's a rigged system when you walk in the door, and it's just not right. And I really am getting, I'm kind of tired of it, because in this case, it unlike a rulemaking where you have comments from the public and you develop some sort of record, here we don't really have that. And when the commissioner says, well, you're going to raise a lot of money for these accounts, what is the factual basis for that? There is none. In fact, based upon my own anecdotal evidence and experience in the field, you probably won't raise a whole lot. It seems like GLAC kind of for everybody. GLAC, of course, is the compliance fund for presidential elections, which raises some money, but it certainly doesn't raise what a full-fledged campaign raises. But there's really no basis to say that other than personal opinion that they're going to raise a lot of money. Moreover, my experience is people don't want to give money if they know it's just going to go to lawyers. right? I mean, on a personal note, Mr. Elias, you probably think in your heart of hearts, it's not really a bad thing if the commission concocts some convoluted, made-up redesignation regime, because then the money will never be able to be touched by the political operatives, and it'll only go to pay for lawyers. It's sort of like a building fund to build a house by the beach that you're going to get to live in, right? So it's good for commerce, but I don't think it's really good for policy. And, you know, wasting a lot of time on nuance is a thing. I don't think it's a waste of time, but it my point is that the little stuff does matter, and to sort of come in and we already have some fallback draft because we know the vote. I mean, that's smart on the one hand, because at least we know where we're going to land, and I guess you can get something to take home, and I understand that concern. But we can't get to the point where it feels like it's rigged. I mean, I walked in and I had, you name it, came out, have you read the consensus draft? No, I haven't read the consensus draft. I want to come in and listen to what people have to say in the room and deliberate as a commissioner, which is what I think we should be doing here, and I don't think we do enough of it. And it's really getting frustrating, particularly not to jump ahead on the agenda, but we, you know, with all this recent case law, we have some tough issues that we really have to talk through, and if we just keep doing this sort of, you know, stick to our usual position things, we're never really going to get to the heart of the matter. And certainly, recount funds is probably not the place to take a big stand on the big picture, but it's the little things tend to cause a problem. It tend to illustrate the larger problems. And you know, since I've joined the commission, the transparency has gone up. You know, you couldn't even get all the old MERS online. I mean, we can go on and on and on about how much stuff really was not public. You learned about the directives a few meetings back. You know, these have been in the public records room for years. No one advertised they were there. But, you know, this isn't really about the substance. It's just about how we do things. And I really think that we can't come out of the gate saying, well, you know where we are. They don't. They don't work here. They don't know what goes on. They don't know who talks to who. They asked an AO because, well, they want an answer to the question. And I think it just discourages people asking for AOs if they feel like, well, everyone's mind's already made up. That's different from commissioners being consistent on positions. I think some of us are quite predictable. I think that's good, because people can at least, you know, rely on that sort of thing. But in the AO process, I think we got to really make an effort to actually try to deliberate and let the public in more on what goes on at the commission, so that the thinking of the commissioners, I think, can be fleshed out instead of coming in here and just blowing through it and, you know, do a couple motions and in and out. So apologize for the long speech, but I really can't keep being a part of this. We have to deliberate in an open meeting, and we can't come in and basically say we already know the answer to the question, because it sort of defeats the deliberation process and frustrates what the law requires, which is an open meeting.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As so frequently happens, I don't know what you're talking about, Commissioner McGann. We particularly you. I'm struggling to think of a time when, as a result of a discussion at the table, you flipped over to my side of the argument. So, you know, I find that comical. But you know, last night, you know, we've been talking about this for obviously since the request came in, and I'm available to talk to you. I'm in favor of more discussion. I'm available anytime you want to talk, Commissioner.
How about now when the public's listening?
We're talking. Have you ever said anything that you were concerned? Gee, I don't know what Commissioner Weintraub thinks about that, and she's so shy, I just don't think she'll weigh in on this topic. I don't think that's a problem. You know, last night it became clear that it was unlikely that we were going to agree on the transfer regulation piece, on the transfer piece of this, not regulation. It was suggested that we should come in and have a discussion and leave it up in the air, and then direct counsel to draft a response based on the discussion at the table, which would not be provided to counsel, and he would not have the opportunity to even look at before we voted on it. Then it would be circulated for a secret tally vote, and we would vote on it that way. And I said, well, that's not very transparent. If we can kind of see the direction of where we're going, why don't we prepare a draft that we can discuss at the table, which I think is what we've been doing. If there are votes for it at the end of the day, there are votes for it, and if not, not. But, you know, my comment was just meant to suggest that Mr. Elias, as a savvy and experienced observer of this group, seeing three drafts, one of which has one answer, one of which has another answer, and one of which seems to go down the middle and say on one issue we can't agree, that he would probably have a sense, looking at those three drafts, of where likely the result was going to be. You know, yeah, sure, somebody might change their vote at the table. I've done that, actually. It's the notion that we don't have that we're not properly discussing these things. I'm here pretty much every day to talk about it, and I'm happy to talk about it here all day long if you want to.
Further discussion or comments?
Sure. Could you ask what's the basis for your statement that the recount funds are going to raise a lot of money? Where's that in the record for this AO? Any comments that support that or anything from the public?
I just find that an unfathomable question. You actually think they're not going to raise money for these recount funds? The last recount, they raised over $2 million. How's that for a fact in the record? And that was for one recount. So now we're saying, you know, these are going to be able to exist in perpetuity. I feel, based on my years of observing people raising money, when they get the opportunity to raise money, that money will be raised. Mr. Elias, do you doubt that money will be raised for these purposes?
I only answer when there are questions.
I just asked you.
I think that there is no question that money will be raised for recounts. In fact, as you know, I brought a number of advisory opinions to try to clarify whether national parties can raise them, state parties can raise them, candidates can raise it, national parties can raise it before an election, national parties can spend it before an election, and now whether what the state party is to do with leftover money. That said, you know, I will point out, just so the record is clear, the DFL raised $2,165,451.53. And it was left over with $11,583.61. So there's a difference between the raising of the money and what is spent and left over. And that I think, you know, it is one thing to say they will raise a lot of money. I think recounts probably are going to stay, you know, are expensive and probably are not going to get less expensive. I do think that's a separate question for you all to consider, what then to do with the remaining funds, which is what we're asking here, which is actually a relatively modest amount.
Other questions or discussion? Commissioner McGann.
I'd like to, if I could, Mr. Chairman, make a motion that we adopt draft B of the advisory opinion.
Any discussion on the motion? I support this motion. Primary concern that's raised in this request is will it circumvent the contribution limits? And as has been pointed out, the recount fund consists of funds that comply with the prohibitions, limitations, and reporting requirements of the Act. That any money transferred will be that there will be an accounting to make sure that there is no excessive contribution that's being received by the federal account when such a transfer would occur. And with that concern being resolved, I think draft B has it right. I think it arrives at the right answer, and consequently I support it. Any further discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No. Nay.
The motion fails on a vote of 3-3, with Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself in favor, and Commissioner Walther, Weintraub, and the Vice Chair opposed. Further motions? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to Advisory Opinion 20-18, you'll forgive me, I need to figure out which document. I believe it's what's considered Draft A, Agenda Document 1059. Is that correct, Council? Thank you. I make that motion, and if I might just have a moment to explain. I am concerned about the travel, the transfer regulation. I think that it does speak specifically to this, and am not able to. That's why I wasn't able to support Draft A. But that said, I do think that in the interest of getting requesters' answers, and I think that is the ultimate goal here. I think that Draft C adequately does that and appropriately does that. And while I hear my colleagues, you know, concern about doing things in public, I think that's what we're here doing today. And I also think we have the other issue. We're required to provide AOs within a certain amount of time and as expeditiously as possible. And to the extent that there may be a compromise available, I do think it is beneficial to provide that not only as soon as possible, but also in the open meeting where we can discuss what the alternative will look like. We've had a number of AOs since I've been at the Commission where we deadlock at the table, and then sometimes it takes a very long time. Sometimes we've had to ask for extensions on the deadlines on several occasions, and then we, you know, put out a draft sort of, you know, in regular course with no ability for further comments or discussion, and particularly now that we have this new procedure where requesters' counsel come and actually talk to us, they can provide us with their views on these things. So I actually think that providing an alternative, which is the logical conclusion to two drafts that are in conflict, provides more transparency. And I don't think it suggests that the decks are stacked. I think it reflects the practical result of having two drafts. And I think that as long as the more discussion we can have here at the table, the better, because I agree that the public is entitled to know the rationale behind these. But I have also been concerned by the results that have occurred in the past where we deadlock at the table and then it takes a significant amount of time and with no ability for comment or discussion adopt a draft much later in the day that is sent to requesters. So at an appropriate time, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to also move draft C, but at this point I will be supporting draft A.
So just to clarify, are you moving draft A at this point?
I have so moved.
Okay. Any further discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify that, I mean, really what this comes down to is a highly technical argument about, you know, does a certain regulation apply? Is it federal funds? Is it not federal funds? Is it covered by other federal funds transfers? Is it limited by another regulation that says you can't move things into federal funds? Is that regulation modified by the ENJ? I don't think that the ENJ can actually modify the plain words of the regulation. So, you know, the ultimate dispute here is on actually quite a technical point of law. And I have, you know, on the issue of whether we should have a draft in front of us, I think, you know, the other alternative is that we actually draft at the table, which I have done from time to time in my years here, and my experience is that it's not a good process to be drafting at the table because people don't have adequate time to think through all the ramifications of every word that they're putting down. So having drafts out, and I know I work very hard to try and get drafts out on all of these matters last week to give people an adequate time to take a look at this, you know, at least the direction of where some commissioners were thinking. I think having drafts done in advance is likely to produce a more thoughtful process and a better thought-through result at the end of the day.
Any further discussion on the motion to regarding draft A? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
No. The motion fails 3-3 with Commissioners Walther, Weintraub, and the Vice Chair in favor, and Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself opposed. Do we have a further motion? Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of Agenda Document 1059B, which is described as draft C in advisory opinion 20-18, and authorize council to make technical and conforming changes.
Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner McGann.
Just a brief comment. The concern on the substance I have with C is what draft C is going to look like or be read years from now. And I've seen this trick before, and it's it's something that the commission's done over many, many years. So I'm not talking to any one person in particular. As a general thought, is that, you know, there's a debate at the table, and then, you know, there's a consensus draft, I guess. But then someone's going to read this someday in the future, potentially. Maybe someone who works at the FEC, maybe the council's office, maybe an auditor is going to say, well, there's an affirmative obligation now to do this redesignation thing. And I have a problem with that. Now, you could say, well, you can write your own separate concurrence and all that kind of thing, or someone's going to have to dig through the votes and see, you know, who voted for what. People don't do that. In fact, the commission doesn't do that. Remember the Canner AO? We sort of cleaned that up in a rulemaking, but the former chair Toner's in the front row. He was there, and there was a number of votes that went 3-3 all day and then ended up with a draft. But then the FEC always cites the actual, you know, consensus draft, and there was a very eloquent concurrence by three commissioners. Mr. Toner was on that draft, probably the primary author. I don't want to, read too much into it, but limited the reach of the Canner AO, but yet the Canner AO was read to cover all kinds of stuff because people forgot at the time that it happened, that was a consensus draft, and that three limited the reach of that draft. Again, not to get ahead of this, but the next item on the agenda, or no, two items down, is going to have, when we get into CalMed and what concurrences are, and people forget what's what, but you have to read the whole file to know what the law is. And this is really, aside from my what the public should know, speech. My concern with draft C is someone's going to take this, and then all of a sudden this is going to become the new legal norm, and everyone's going to start doing all this stuff. There's going to be no rulemaking, no notice. No one's going to really get to go to court until there's a long MER, because you don't get to go to court sooner. Although if you had asked for the AO and you're somebody, you won't be able to get another bite at the apple. So if you want to go to court, you can, but the next person can't per Unity 08. Maybe you can take an audit finding to court now under Unity 08. Who knows? I think you probably can. But that's a whole other debate. So the draft C, I appreciate the idea of having a draft as a fallback to have something so we're not up here floundering around with pens and trying to write things at the table. I certainly get that, and that's generally the way to go. But my concern with this, with these consensus drafts, is it's going to take on a life of its own. I've seen it happen before. It happened in the Canner AO. It could happen here. I mean, this whole recount thing has taken on a life of its own, and it's now a creature that we're hitting forks in the road that I think a lot of us are very uncomfortable even hitting. And with that, draft C to me is that's a tough one, because although I agree that if you do all this stuff, which is not mandated by the regs, but merely imported onto your client by analogy, you're going to have the protection of an AO, because my sense is there's sufficient votes for this. But this is not a new rule. This is not a new law. This is not a new legal norm. And not all of us think you have to do all this stuff. But if you do, my sense is at least you're going to be protected. So that's my concern with these drafts that sort of fall back to positions that end up being read differently down the road when it's a different group reading the AO.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. An AO is a request from one requester. He has a question. He said, well, can I do it this way? If I can't do it that way, can I do it this other way? And I think we all agree that if he follows the procedure that he has laid out and said that he's going to follow, we all agree that, I think, that he's certainly not going to be breaking any laws that way. There clearly is some sentiment for allowing a more liberal interpretation and allowing him to do even more and not having to go through these hoops, but that doesn't have majority votes either. So what we have, and what often happens, and you know, we'll see this later in the day, and we've certainly seen it before, is one requester comes in, and then somebody else says, wow, I could really use some that AO. So, you know, while you're answering that AO, could you also kind of throw in something that's going to help, you know, us do what we want to do, try and hijack the AO for some other purpose and turn it into this broader rule of, now we have a new rule of how you go about doing, with all due respect to counsel who are doing their job, that happens too. But this AO stands for the proposition that this requester has come in and said, if I do this, am I okay? And we're saying, yes, if you do this, you're okay. And I think on that, there actually is consensus. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks he's breaking the law if he goes through these, you know, whether everybody, it's clear that everybody doesn't think it's required, but certainly there's nothing, he's not breaking any laws by doing it, and everybody believes that this is permissible and that he'll be, as you say, protected. And what other people take from it, of course, who may be in slightly different circumstances, that's, you know, that's a question for another day. But, you know, today, all I think we're doing is answering Mr. Elias's question, Mr. Burkhan's, on behalf of this client, DFL.
Commissioner McGann.
I appreciate that. I wholeheartedly agree. We're only answering the question before us, but just in my experience, I've seen sometimes AOs take on lives of their own, and people forget that it's only the question being asked. And I also have to thank you for referring to my position as the more liberal position.
I don't do that too often.
Not since the 1940s.
Liberal
my position
in the sense of
liberal.
Liberal in the sense of libertarian.
Any further discussion? I saw Commissioner Walther reach for the microphone, but I
no.
Did you have an okay?
I'll just vote.
I share the concern that Commissioner McGann expressed about wanting to make sure that any vote on this is taken in its proper context. The requester did, Mr. Elias did present an alternative scenario to us, and I don't think that a requester would have done that if that wasn't. Obviously, I don't think it was the preferred scenario, and like my vote on draft B indicates, I think that the primary request that he put forward, I agreed with. I don't think that that presented any legal problems. But in terms of this alternative, I agree that that this certainly does not run afoul of the commission regulations or of the Act. And I think there needs to be a distinction between necessary and sufficient. What is the scenario that's set forth in the alternative is certainly sufficient to comply with the commission's regulations and with the Act. I don't see this as being necessary, and obviously we're going to have a disagreement amongst ourselves about what's necessary and what's not, but it's certainly sufficient. I think that that this draft should be taken in that proper context and shouldn't be read as establishing a new norm that this is what has to happen in order for these monies to be transferred or redesignated. We're not creating a new rule of law through this AO. Requester presented an alternative scenario for us to consider, and I agree that this and the other both comply with the Act. But the votes aren't there, but I'm willing to support draft C. Any further discussion? If none, do we have a motion? Oh, motion is already on the table. Being that there's no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. And we will move on to the next matter.
Thanks.
Okay. Can we take a... Let's move on to the next matter. Next item on the agenda is discussion of draft advisory opinion 2010-19, the Google AO. We again have Mr. Elias and Mr. Burkhan representing the requester. And we have a presentation from Tony Buckley from the Office of General Counsel. And good morning. It still is morning, so good morning to you. And
good morning,
please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, commissioners. Agenda documents 1061, 1061A, and 1061B contain four draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of Google Incorporated. Google is a for-profit corporation that creates programs and applications that allow persons to search for and collect information on the Internet. Google's AdWords program generates text ads in conjunction with keywords chosen by the advertiser. These text ads are limited to 95 characters, up to 25 for the headline, and up to 70 for two lines of text and a display URL. Google asks whether disclaimers are required on text ads generated on behalf of candidates and political committees through the AdWords program. Draft A and revised Draft A initially addressed Google's question as to whether the small items exception to the disclaimer provision applies to text ads, and conclude that it does not. These drafts then conclude that the disclaimer requirement is satisfied if the text ad displays the URL of the committee sponsor's website and the landing page contains a full disclaimer meeting the requirements of 11 CFR 110.11. Draft B concludes that the text ads qualify for the impracticable exception to the disclaimer requirement and that, therefore, disclaimers are not required to be appended to text ads generated through the AdWords program. Draft C concludes that under the circumstances described in the request, where the text ad displays the URL of the committee sponsor's website in the text ad, and the landing page contains a full disclaimer meeting the requirements of 11 CFR 110.11, the use of the AdWords program by candidates and political committees is permissible under the Act and Commission regulations. The Commission received two comments on the request and two comments on drafts A and B. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Buckley. Any discussion amongst the commissioners or any questions for the requester? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Elias, for presenting us yet again with another interesting question. We lost my old friend, former Commissioner Toner, from the front row. I've always been a supporter of technological innovations, and I think we have to be willing to adapt to what happens with new technology. I fondly remember the internet rulemaking that Commissioner, I regret he's not, I don't know where he disappeared to, because, you know, he and I wrote that rule together, and I was going to thank him for that again, because I think that actually was perhaps our best work. The basis of the internet regulation that we wrote was that public communications, when they include other forms of general public political advertising, shall not include communications over the internet except for communications placed for a fee on another person's website. And those would be treated, I don't know where he went either. Those would be treated, I assume the gentleman who is sitting next to him is with him and will report back to him that I said nice things about him in his absence.
He's back.
There he is. See, now they are saying all these
all
nice things about you.
I think she'd rather hear from you, it sounds like.
I was expecting the bailiff to say, all rise. When
Actually, we have all heard from former Commissioner Toner.
Having his portrait finalized for the lobby.
Hey, getting those portraits on the wall was a big deal. When we wrote the internet regulation, we stipulated that the one thing we were going to regulate were communications placed for a fee on another person's website, and that those would be treated just like communications placed for a fee in a newspaper or in a broadcast ad or anywhere else, and would require a disclaimer. And I think that regulation has been widely applauded. In fact, I can't remember another regulation that this commission has ever issued that was so popular as that internet regulation. But I think that we do need to be careful while we are encouraging technological developments. I think we do need to be careful to be sure that we don't vitiate the regulation and chip away at it to the point where, we're sort of back to the regulation that we started out with that got overturned in court, which was a total exemption on everything over the internet. So I think it's important to preserve those disclaimers. I think it's the Supreme Court has endorsed the notion, and Congress obviously has too, that it's important for people to know who's talking to them and where the message is coming from. And it's tempting to put this into the small items box or the impracticable box or some other box in the regulations because what you want to do is small, although perhaps not small in the same way that a pen is small. I mean, you can only make a pen so big. Otherwise, you won't be able to fit your hand around it. And, you know, if you say, well, you could just make the pen bigger and then you'd have more room for a disclaimer on it, you know, that's not really going to work for people when they actually want to write with it. So I think that, as I said, it's really important to preserve the notion that paid ads on the Internet do carry disclaimers. I think that the proposal that you've made, and again, we are only addressing the proposal of this requester. We've had a flurry of comments from former commissioners representing other folks in the tech community, and that's always welcomed. And those other entities may have slightly different concerns, and they may have slightly different business models. And if they have questions, we'd be happy to hear from them. And we know they're well advised and are able to submit their requests. But what this requester wants to do is to have these little ad words with the URL on the side, and then you click on that, and you get to the landing page, and there will be a full disclaimer. And I think that is really key, that disclaimer be there and be available so that people will know the source of the ad. So I was... because I am concerned about chipping away at the regulation, I was unable to support putting this in the small items box or in the impractical box, and therefore I supported my first choice would be draft A, I think. That was our draft. I think we ended up on the A's. Yes, revised draft A. Excuse me. We made some amendments to it. We rushed it out before the Jewish holidays last week and had to make a few amendments to it. But I do appreciate the way the requester has constructed the request in such a way to promote disclosure and to make it possible for everybody who is reading these ads to see where they're coming from.
Further questions or discussion? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a tough one because we're into, to me, a new factual area, and that's the Internet. And I know the Internet's not new, but for purposes of this AO, it's new because this is a different kind of advertising than that which those in politics have used over the past couple hundred years. To me, my process on this is I went online, I looked at Google, I had to remind myself where these ads were, and at best I take it, it's the three ads at the top of the page and the ones in the right-hand margin, and they're basically a fixed size. Everybody gets the same size ad. And, the look and feel of the page is nice. You can read it. The font size is pretty good. I noticed that I may need reading glasses soon, but I don't with the Google ads because they're symmetrical and that kind of thing. And it struck me that this is really no different than a bumper sticker type ad, and it seemed to me come within the small items. And I certainly hear Commissioner Weintraub on the need for letting people know who is sponsoring the ad. I mean, that's the general rule. It's been upheld by the courts. This commission has embraced that. One of the first AOs that we voted on was when Club for Growth came in and asked about truncated disclaimers or no disclaimers on their 15-second TV ads. And we all voted to say, no, you still need disclaimers. And that actually was part of the CU case that went up, and the court basically agreed with the FEC. So imagine that happened. This, to me, though, is different because this is more, to me, like a bumper sticker. I don't see it as a hard question because, to me, and I've raised this in the hall with someone, I don't recall who, and I said, well, it seems to me it's small and it's also impractical. And the response was, well, Google could just sort of change the size of the ad and make it bigger. And I thought, well, that's odd. The federal government's going to tell Google how to do their ads. You're laughing. That there's hope for you yet, Mr. Elias. That we're going to, the FEC is empowered to tell Google how to do ads. I mean, Google is just really a middleman on this. I mean, the disclaimer obligation, to the extent there is one, is going to be on whoever is paying for the ad, the political committee, right? Now, Google wants to make sure they don't get in trouble, and probably give a piece of paper to people who buy ads saying, sure, you can use our ads, because somebody probably raised this issue somewhere and got everybody confused and said this may be an issue, and now here you are. The question I have for you, though, is this notion that it's not a small item like a bumper sticker would then mean you could make this fit somehow, or it's not, maybe it is practical to put it on there. It seems to me you'd have to change your technology. My guess is Google's not inclined to do that, but any sense how tough that would be to do, business model-wise, financially, copyright law-wise, technology-wise? Take your pick.
I'm not a technology expert. I'm a marginal campaign finance lawyer at best.
That's not what Toner says.
I only feel bad he was out of the room for the laudatory comments that he received.
I tried. You left at the wrong moment.
To me, it is a confusing question. I mean, there are questions I come in where I think I think he's writing a book, Known Unknowns and Unknown Unknowns. And companies come in a lot of time for questions where they think it's a more of a known unknown. I suppose the same question was asked and could have been asked and was asked of Target Wireless, why they just don't make their text messages longer.
Right.
I mean, why let
that decision get in the way?
So in some respects, the commission ruled in Target Wireless that 160 characters was impractical or was a small item. Now I suppose the commission is deciding that perhaps 95 characters is not a small item or impractical.
I certainly don't feel empowered to make that kind of decision.
Mark, let me
ask a question.
I'm sorry.
The question though is, and the wireless AO is a good example. I mean, to all of a sudden add characters to put a disclaimer, that's really not practical for Google unless they want to spend a lot of money completely redoing their site. And it's a valuable. I mean, my guess is you probably copyrighted the actual screenshot and how it looks and all. And if somebody came up with a site that looked remarkably similar, even substantially similar, to put it in copyright, you'd probably dig off those old look and feel cases that probably really aren't good law anymore for video games, but probably throw it on the Google page. And it seems to me that that's just not practical to go with the full disclaimer, right? I mean, can you sort of help flesh out factually why that is, other than saying, well, we all know it's not easy to do?
If that is a question, I would have to take it back to the company to address the specifics of the technology. I think it's fair to say, though, that what they sell is a commercial product, that this is what they sell, and, why they don't sell it differently, why don't they make bigger cars or smaller cars or cars with more features or fewer features?
That's not really a good analogy, because the government tells cars manufacturers all the stuff they got to do, right? But in this case, it's a private company that made a business decision on how they want to sell advertising, and it's really not up to us to sort of do that. So moving on, next question. There's the notion floating around that, well, if the URL kind of says who it is, and if you click on it and it goes to a political committee page and they have a disclaimer, well, that's cool, that'll work, right? That's not a problem. Seems to be where that's coming from. Does that work for your client in this case?
I don't know that I've ever been in this position before. We support both draft A and draft B, and would actually like to see a unified decision that permits either approach.
Let me ask you this then. The idea that you go to another page, it has a disclaimer. Now, this is I'm kind of sucker punching you on this one, because this is a different client of yours. But let's say the DSCC has a Google ad and has a link to your Facebook page. Right, which actually happens to be here, and there's no disclaimer on your Facebook page because Facebook doesn't have disclaimers. It's kind of funny because it says you have 138,459 people like this. That's not a lot of people.
Sounds like a lot of people to me.
If you read the newspapers, that sounds like a lot of people, I guess, compared to other things. But you don't have a disclaimer on this. So even though you say, well, there'll be a disclaimer, it'll cure it. What if you send people to a page that doesn't have a disclaimer, you're representing Google here today. Google is fine with either, but as a practical matter, how's this going to work out?
Just to be clear, Google's preference is not either; it's both. When I say either, it is that you can satisfy. That what this commission did right in the internet rulemaking was not try to guess what the future technology is, but rather let the technology develop. And I worry a little bit about the unintended consequences of telling Google that it is only draft A or only draft B. It strikes me that you can say you can satisfy the requirements either by either approach, either that it's a small item, or, and therefore you don't need a disclaimer, or by having the link to a website. And that will achieve a result that will benefit multiple technologies, some which, so that you don't have someone who comes in at 97 characters next and 106 characters after that and 172 characters. They can say, you know what, we'll just link to a website. And for Google, that feels comfortable at 95 characters, that their technology doesn't permit further expansion, they'll say it's a small item. It seems to me that I may be more liberal, undoubtedly, than you are.
Capital L, yes.
But I'm suggesting that there. It seems to me that the commission, the best thing for the commission to do, with having floated these two alternatives, is to actually find either approach permissible.
Just my final point to make. Go back to the small items. My sales pitch on that. My sense is when that exception was put in, it also wasn't particularly practical to put disclaimers on bumper stickers because of the ink used and the size, right? And the ink would bleed. Remember the old bumper stickers? And you'd try to do, you know, the union bug, and it would end up being just a mush of white ink on the blue background. But you still put the union bug on it because the union shop printed the bumper stickers, or if you didn't use union shop, it saved you that squish of whatever that is. But you really couldn't put the, you know, the paid for by and all that kind of stuff. Nowadays, you kind of can, right? Desktop publishing, the ink's better, it's a lot crisper. You actually could. I mean, I've actually seen people put disclaimers, you know, on T-shirts and hats and mugs, and you know, some folks do it to make a political statement, right? There's a guy, saw a TV ad the other day where a guy has a stand by your ad saying this is, you know, the government mandated incumbent protection disclaimer, and I stand by this ad. You know, like, not illegal to do that, you know. So, but that's he's kind of making that his stand, and that's his prerogative, I guess. But you know, to me, just because you can force a disclaimer doesn't necessarily mean you have to, because in this context, is there a slippery slope that we have to worry about if on Google? Now, another web browser comes up with a different kind of ad, that may be a different question. But, you know, we're dealing with Google ads. We know what Google ads are, a certain size. It's you basically have one or two sentences saying, you know, so-and-so's for change. Click here for more information. It's very much a bumper sticker style hit and run. There's not a lot of content. There's not a lot of development of issues, nor can there be. It's a quick kind of thing. And what I don't know is there a concern that you're going to get fake Google ads or you know, weird negative ads or things that really you need that voters would want to know who it is, because this one or two sentences is really going to persuade them to pull the lever for or against somebody, as opposed to clicking the link and figuring out more information. Seems to you understand where I'm going with this is if the rationale for a disclaimer is to allow voters and the public to know who's paying for things, so they can weight the value of the message and all this kind of stuff. Is this really the kind of message that's carrying us so much heft that we have to jump through 50 hoops to make sure there's a disclaimer on it? I don't think so. I think it's more of a bumper sticker where it's a quick splash, and if someone is really wants to be persuaded, they're going to click and find out what's going on anyway and find out who the source is and that sort of thing. So I'm not really sure if there's a slippery slope here if we don't require some sort of disclaimer or the fallback of, well, if the page you go to has a disclaimer, which is beyond Google's control, right? If you click through to a committee and they don't have a disclaimer requirement, is that a violation by Google? I don't think so, but I'd be curious to know if others think it is. Do you see any downside? And I actually really to argue the opposite side of the proposition. Any downside here that could lead to mischief or frustration of disclosure and disclaimers? If we don't go whole hog here.
Look, I think that this commission took great pride under the leadership of Commissioner Weintraub and and Chairman Toner, or Commissioner Toner at the time.
Been well established here today.
In the, right. Yeah. Joining that chorus in finding that the Internet is a democratizing instrument in American politics. It allows smaller players to have more voice. It takes money out of 30-second ads and allows smaller campaigns to do more to reach voters. It is a more democratic way of bringing more people into the process. It is a societal good, and it is something that the Commission has found to be a good thing for politics, and something that ought not to be the source of strangling regulation. That, I think, is the history of where the Commission's been. I think that Target Wireless fit into that in seeing an emerging new technology that campaigns would use. And I think in some respects, you know, campaigns, you give one example, campaigns are already using Facebook. They're already using Twitter. They're already using Google. They're already using Yahoo. And I guess I would caution the unintended consequence of something that the Commission might do that is seen as halting that forward, which is why I really think that there is an opportunity for all sides of this, rather than adopting what is draft C, which I think is viewed as the consensus draft, which is to pare down lowest common denominator. I would actually urge you consensus draft the other way and say, you know what, you're right. We can actually put disclaimers on pens. I get disclaimers with pens. I get pens with disclaimers all the time. I get buttons with disclaimers all the time. It's not impractical.
You can make a bigger bumper sticker. It would cover up the whole back of your car. Minivans have disclaimers. You can have a whole sort of thing.
The fact is, it's not a technological limitation that excludes those things. The idea is that there's a nature. There's something in the nature of a small item or where it's impractical, not in a purely technological sense, because you could print small on a pen, but rather it's the kind of thing that we don't think, where we don't think a disclaimer is necessary. I think the Commission took a sensible position in Target Wireless, where I might point out there were two drafts, and the Commission rejected a very similar situation. The Commission actually rejected the more restrictive draft and went with the more permissive, and I think it's only helped the Internet. It has only helped the democratization of politics on the Internet. We see more and more spending on, whether it's Google or Yahoo or Facebook or Twitter, we see more and more campaign spending, more and more there, and that is a societal good. It poses no risk to the campaign finance system, and it's something this Commission has made a hallmark of of them in the past. So, you know, for what it's worth, the answer to your question, Commissioner, is there a slippery slope? I fear there is, and I fear that no one in this room is going to necessarily know what that next technology is, and I'd hate for it to go off, not be able to get born because of what was seen as...
So I take it you're not a fan of draft C.
Look,
because that kind of goes...
I leave draft... Am I a fan of draft C? I mean, compared to what? You know, compared to what? I think the Commission ought to take the same approach it has taken in the past. And I think a disclaimer on a website ought to be something that for technologies that use that, where maybe there's longer characters, they ought to see that and say, okay, this is a way we can meet the disclaimer requirement. I think for folks that are at smaller number of characters, they ought to be able to say, you know what, we're safe under the small item exception.
I could, Mr. Chairman, just for two points, I want to note for the record that I think some folks have filed some ex parte notices on this. Mr. Toner did call a bunch of us. I didn't talk to him, so I've not filed an ex parte notice, but I want the record to reflect why I didn't file one. We actually didn't talk. I called you back after hours and apologized for the late call, but I'm sure it was regarding your comments because he's here. He had filed comments on behalf of Facebook. And just to end on a lighter note, the DSCC page here actually has some ads in the right-hand margin. I'm not making this up. It has an ad here for the Cato Institute, balancing liberty and security here on the DSCC page. But it says here experts from the ACLU and Cato Institute discuss how to balance individual liberties with security in this age of terrorism. So there's the DSCC page with advertisements from Cato. And my understanding is when you do an ad on Facebook, it usually links to your own Facebook page. So although we want to answer the question here today for Google, we could inadvertently sort of suffocate the next guy, essentially a competitor. Not really, Facebook's not really a competitor to Google, I guess. Unless Google wants to get into that area, then they would be. But you know, it gets tricky. And to me, this is your response to my question. I thought was very good, and you kind of get the gist of it, which is like a bumper sticker is a different nature of speech, right? It's a different. This is a different creature than what we're used to, and how things are on the internet is to me more like a bumper sticker than a TV ad. So for me, I don't see this as a big deal. I see it as a bigger deal that we get in the way of potential development of more technologies, because ultimately the internet is really the best way to reach individual voters nowadays, right? TV ads have kind of lost their luster. The 30-second splash, right? People DVR it, they fast forward through this stuff. And, you know, internet seems to be more the way to go. You got to balance that, though, with what the general proposition is, which is disclosure. But in this case, I think we run the risk of cutting too tight if we're not careful. And I leave it with that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I go back to some of our earlier discussions about what we're doing here today, which is answering a specific question from a specific requester. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, what other people might want to do, but those are other people. This isn't a rulemaking. If we were going to do another, you know, I'm not saying that might not be, you know, maybe every couple of years we ought to do a new rulemaking. I see former Commissioner Toner wincing in the background. No, that was a great rulemaking. We got really interesting comments on that. You know, maybe every couple of years we ought to do a rulemaking where we just explore technology and you know, new developments in politics. But that's not what we're doing here today. What you've come in with is a proposal, and you said, you know, we're going to and you know, in answer to my colleague's question about are you in trouble if somebody else doesn't have a disclaimer, I don't think the answer to that is yes. I mean, maybe that person ought to be here making the request. Maybe you're the wrong, your client is the wrong requester for...
Would you like me to switch with Toner?
Maybe. I'm not sure that he's the... No, I think it's the people who advertise that really are the appropriate requesters for this kind of advice. They want to know what they can do. I think, you know, for Google, it's and I have to say that I might be a little bit off my game this morning. I'm a little tired because as I was going through this last night, I got a little distracted. I did a few Google searches. I checked my Facebook page. It's very distracting. But
you haven't friended me.
Are you on Facebook?
Of course, I'm on Facebook.
I he's my friend.
Toner's my friend. You on Facebook?
What?
Have you friended me?
Yeah.
You have?
So. You don't
We're
even
friends?
Know who your friends
so.
Are.
No, I have so many. It's Facebook. I mean, I don't even police my own Facebook page, let alone his.
Toner won't friend me.
Actually, in case you're going to send me that friend request later, Commissioner, let me just warn you that I tend not to friend people that I do business with. It's more of a personal platform, with a few, you know, just a few.
No. Buckley's looking at me like, wait, what's going to happen now? I don't. Wow. Okay.
I know other people who do that too. But in any event, you know, it's a fun medium. Sorry, got very distracted. I told you I was distracted today. You know, you've come in with a request, and your request stipulates that this business model that, you know, Google obviously wants to be able to tell people, hey, you know, we check with the FEC and you're okay if you do this, involves having a landing page with a full disclaimer. That is a great business plan. That's a great model from my perspective. I think I'm a little bit more concerned than my colleague about making sure that we have these disclaimers to the greatest extent possible. I mean, you know, bumper stickers, yeah, I guess you can put them on bumper stickers, but, you know, maybe it'll cause car accidents if people have to get that close to the car in front of them to see what the disclaimer says. As it is, you see a lot of things where you see people creeping up on somebody else's bumper and saying, what does that bumper sticker say? That's really intriguing when the print gets too fine. But, you know, this is not a rulemaking. To go back to my real point here, this isn't a rulemaking. We're not here to provide protection to a bunch of of other folks out there that might have very good ideas about how to move forward and how to develop new ways of distributing political information. And when those people come in and ask us for a question, you know, that presents, you know, at some point we may have to confront that actual question. Well, what happens if for some reason there's no way to provide the disclaimer and all you've got is 95 characters? Does that mean, you know, you are you inside the box? Are you outside the box? Can you use the small items or not? I mean, we don't actually have to confront that today. I understand your desire for, you know, the greater community to have an AO that says, yeah, you can do this, you can do that, you can do the other thing. But you are doing one particular thing. Your request posits a particular scenario, which those of us who are very concerned that we have the greatest possible disclosure of who's funding all kinds of ads, you know, you have satisfied us, and Google's plan has satisfied us, and we are happy. I recognize that it's, the wording is kind of funny on the draft C, but the point of it is to say, yes, this plan works. People who follow this plan and have adequate disclaimers on the landing page, they're going to be okay. And the next one who comes along and wants to do something slightly different and wants to make a case for why they can't do the landing page and they can't do the disclaimer and why it's impracticable for them or why it's just not going to work, you know, we'll just have to confront that one when it comes up. But I do think there's a, you know, we have to acknowledge the difference between an AO request and a rulemaking. We, you know, in a rulemaking, we could, you know, bring in a bunch of witnesses, and then we could have, you know, Michael Turner come up at the witness table, and maybe Dave Mason. We had a lot of former commissioners weighing in on this one, and we get a wider range of information. Now we have one particular proposal in front of us, and that's what we are ruling on. And I think that, I without prejudging, I think that my impression is that pretty much everybody is comfortable with the plan that you have proposed and is willing to, you know, give you an opinion that provides that comfort.
Can we take just a brief 2-minute recess? The open meeting is back in order. Commissioner Hunter.
Yes, one quick question, Mr. Elias. In one of the, and I have to say for the record that I did file an ex parte communication that I had with Mr. Toner yesterday, and we talked about the comment he submitted on September 21st. I subsequently ran into him in the hallway a few minutes ago, just by coincidence, and he said that he didn't see draft C in before he got here, so he didn't have any comment to respond to draft C. And when I talked to him yesterday, I didn't tell him about draft C because there was no draft C. So that's a long way of saying that I would like to get public comment on draft C before I vote for it. But before, I also have a question for you, Mr. Elias, about the comments that Mr. Toner filed, and it follows up a little bit on what my colleague, Commissioner McGann, was talking about. What about the idea that the URLs that are often placed within these ads are often misleading? Because they don't accurately reflect who's paying for the ad.
Well, I think, is this on? Can you hear me? Wait, yeah,
yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, I couldn't tell if the microphone was on. In terms of the two points, one is the public comment, I think, you know, probably makes sense because, like I said, I didn't see draft C before this morning either. I think that, you know, as talking about transparency on the internet, that probably would make sense if the commission needs to go there, as opposed to adopting another approach. What the structure of our opinion did was ask the small items question. Okay, the commission had already said 160 characters are small items. We asked whether 95 characters were small items, being smaller than 160. We then asked, not in the alternative in the traditional sense of we're fine with, you know, A is, you know, we'll do A, we'll do B, but rather if it's not A, if it's not that, if it's not small items, then if we have these other requirements, does that meet the law, and for the user? And the fact is Google AdWords include the URL, So that's a fact. I mean, that's just a fact. That's a fact whether the commission rules small items. It's a fact whether the commission adopts what was our alternative two. It's a fact whether the commission adopts Mr. Toner's alternative two or 2A, whatever you would call it. I mean, the fact is the way Google AdWords work is that it has that URL, and it has it because it gives the user a sense of where they're going before they get there. It's another measure of transparency in the internet experience. So, from our standpoint, that's something we will do. That's something Google will do. Whether it's a dispositive fact, an important fact or not, I understand Mr. Toner's position that it shouldn't be a determining fact. But we posited it as, if you read our opinion, it is quite descriptive. We have tried to go out of our way to describe to you all the different ways that the ads present and what the technology how the technology operates, how the purchase process operates, and one of the facts is that we have a disclaimer in the name. I do think that the commission ought to decide what it's going to do with Target Wireless if it doesn't go small items, because that strikes me. I don't know if 160 characters is small or impractical, and 95 characters isn't small and impractical. I think that's going to be a challenge.
Commissioner Walther.
Well, I guess we're going to put this off. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But I wanted to disclose the fact that I talked to Mr. Toner yesterday. I never refused to take his call. And he did want to raise the issue with respect to whether or not if there was an URL on there, it should not be misleading and it should really be represented by the sponsor of the ad. I think that's, I told him I agree with that. And we have a couple of drafts there here. If we both voted 3-3 on each one, you'd have your answer in terms of going ahead. And I'm not sure. I think we'll put it off, as I understand it, and look to see if there's a draft C. But I just wanted to disclose the fact that I talked to Mr. Toner and what we talked about, and the fact that I said that I think that's true. If we're going to have any URL in there, and I think Google made it quite clear it intended to do just that. So I think you have an answer within the confines of the letter, one way or the other. I'm not too sure there'll be nuances on this point on how he reached the answer.
Mr. Lyons.
May I just offer a clarifying point? From Google's standpoint, there is the only way a URL is misleading is if it's the wrong URL. So right. Google is going to continue to put the URL of the site that you are clicking to. That is not, from an internet standpoint, that is not misleading. That's actually truthful. It's telling you this is the site you're going to go to. So I don't want the commission to be misled about and as it uses the term, misleading. If you click a site that says, Smith Sucks, right? That Smith Sucks may be owned by some party committee or some other committee, but the URL is going to still be www.smithsucks.com. And that's not misleading, because that is in fact where they're going, even if it is paid for by another.
Regardless of whether one thinks of Smith. Same point I made in the last AO when we these fallback drafts. I mean, it's good to have it drafted, but again, without the public's ability to sort of see how we think, what the questions we're going to ask, that kind of thing, it's tough to really have a meaningful debate without public input. I agree with Commissioner Hunter that I would like to let folks comment on draft C and not just Facebook, right? There's other folks in the room who may want to weigh in on this. Maybe if they don't weigh in, that says they don't think it's that big a deal. But this is important because these little AOs lead to bigger things. And if we don't think this through now, we have to make sure we'll pay the price later. Draft C to me gives you nothing. It creates the appearance that the commission agreed on something and entered an AO, and it avoids the sort of put it in scare quotes, the deadlock and all that kind of thing. But all that's a natural part of the process that an agency has to go through. And there's nothing wrong with the commission train wrecking a bunch of times on votes until they find the common ground. That's how it's supposed to work. And folks can write in the newspaper the same story they always write about it. And at this point, I don't care. Never did. Some people did. Some people used to. Who cares? We got to get the right answer. C is not the right answer because, although it seems to state the obvious, right, that your text ads are going to display the URL, okay, but it also says the landing page contains a full disclaimer meeting the requirements of 11 CFR 110.11. Therefore, you're okay. Google has no clue whether or not the landing page complies with 11 CFR 110.11. Is that correct, Mr. Elias?
I'm sorry. I was reading C.
Yeah. Well, it is. That's part of the problem is you haven't had a really chance to read it until you're sitting here.
Right.
And now we get to put you on the spot. But if you turn to page 3.
Yes.
Okay. Conclusion. Right. It says the commission concludes that under the circumstances described in the request, the alternative proposed by the requester, open paren, whether the text ad displays the URL of the committee sponsor's website in the text ad, and the landing page contains a full disclaimer meeting the requirements of 11 CFR 110.11, is permissible under the Acting Commission regulations. Certainly, you don't violate the law if you have all that. But what I don't know, I understand you know that the URL is going to be there because Google controls the content of the Google ad. But whether or not the landing page complies with 11 CFR 110.11, how's Google know that? You don't.
I mean, that would be something we would leave to the user. You know,
right.
So
let's say your customer gives you a URL for a page that doesn't comply. The AO doesn't give you protection. It's a complete symbolic piece of paper that doesn't really give you the protection because it's a fact that's really not within your control. And what if that fact's different and you don't have the protection of an AO? To me, this is why we need a little bit of comment on this idea, because this could be one of these fallback drafts that ends up being something that those who vote for it don't really think of at the time, but then down the road it takes on a life of its own in another era of election law. So I agree with Commissioner Hunter that I can't support draft C today, maybe down the road, depending on what this really means, but right now is not the time to do this this way. Thank you.
Mr. Lash, you'd mentioned that you'd be willing to allow this to be held over to consider comments may come in regarding draft C. I believe that the 60-day period on your request expires on October 4th, and I believe the next scheduled meeting of the commission is on October 7th. So before we could actually hold it over, we would need to seek your consent to hold it over those additional 3 days, to extend that period for 3 days.
I strongly suspect that that's not a problem and it will be my recommendation, but I actually need to check with the client just to ensure that that's the case.
Okay. Would it be worthwhile to take just a brief recess so you can do that, just so that we can all have Vice Chair.
Sorry, this is related to what Commissioner McGann was talking about. And I'm certainly not opposed to providing additional opportunity for comment on draft C, but draft C repeats what's in the request. On page 7, the request says the commission should consider the requirement satisfied if the text ad displays the URL, the sponsoring committee's website, and the landing page contains a full section 110.11 disclaimer. So I think that the goal of draft C is to state your request is fine in whatever, you know, non-legal phrasing that is. So I don't think it's imposing anything new on what the requester is asking. In fact, it is, you know, following, and then there's a long discussion of what the full 110.11 disclaimer is. It's actually part of the request. So I don't think that this is a leap beyond what the requester is asking. And I think my goal is always to, whenever possible, provide an answer to the requester. It may not be the full answer the requester is looking for, but to the extent there is some set of 4 votes for some answer to the requester, I think that's what we should be doing. And that, I think, was, you know, I think the appropriate motivation behind draft C. And it is unfortunate that it came out so late, and I think there have been a lot of efforts to try to get things out earlier. So I think we should continue to work on that, and that's on the 9th floor of trying to make sure that we can provide the public with sufficient notice. I think it's an important part that sometimes, frankly, we're not very good at. So providing additional time, if the requester's going to provide us with some additional days, I think is a fine idea.
Let's take a break.
Joan, do we have a consensus then? We will put it over if there is consent given.
Yes. Okay. That's if we get the extension, then this matter will be held over. So let's take a brief recess.
meeting is back in session. Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you for checking with your client, Mr. Elias, and to my colleagues for your indulgence in this endeavor. I just wanted to make one further point. While I think it's perfectly within our authority to answer just the narrow question that the requester asks, and I think you can easily read the statute just to read exactly that way, I think you also, we should also consider that, and Commissioner McGinn sort of talked about this earlier, that despite what we think when we're voting for it, the regulated community, the public out there, is interpreting this and trying to act within the four corners of an advisory opinion. Maybe they don't want to ask for an advisory opinion, maybe they don't have time, but an advisory opinion under 437F is a request concerning the application of the Act. Yes, it's to a specific request, but that the answer to that request has broad ramifications beyond just what the requester is asking. And the first thing that comes to mind is our lovely little candidate solicitation rule that we just voted out a month or two ago, is that? Does it bring back good memories? Because as we all remember, we spent hours and hours talking about the Cantor, and as also Commissioner McGinn brought up, the Cantor line of AOs. And you know, everything that we did in that rulemaking was sort of about what did this AO say, what did that AO say. You know, one of the draft alternatives that went out was based completely on the Cantor line of AOs. You know, regardless of the fact that RGA asked for one of those and other people asked for different ones, everybody in the whole political world was operating under those AOs. Ask John McCain. I mean, someone filed a MER against him because of those AOs. He never asked a question about it, as far as I know, but he ended up, you know, going through a long, lengthy MER process, two probable cause hearings, and I don't recall anybody ever saying, oh, those AOs don't matter to you because you didn't ask the question. So anyway, his conduct didn't arguably fall within the letter of the AOs, but I don't think his conduct was against the law as we voted. Anyway, it's a long way of saying that the AOs do have broader ramifications than just what the requester is asking. Thank you.
From what I understand, we're still waiting to hear back from...
Which we are, which is why I'm not being rude. I'm actually sitting with my BlackBerry here because I'm hoping to...
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of points, and you know, maybe I think it might make sense for us to move on and deal with another AO while we wait for the word back from our requester. Yes and no. I mean, you know, we've had interesting debates as to whether AOs have precedential value and whether MERS have precedential value, and you know, people's views on that tend to change depending on whether they want to rely on those AOs or not. As every AO states right in it, and as the statute states, it's a response to a specific transaction. It's not about general application of the law. It's about a specific transaction, and it says our boilerplate language, which we changed and made more elaborate when this group of commissioners started working together, says, although I think this has been there for a long time, any person involved in any specific transaction or activity which is indistinguishable in all material aspects from the transaction or activity with respect to which this advisory opinion is rendered may rely on this advisory opinion. And I think that that's important because we want to get public comment, because we don't want to be, you know, off there, you know, making broad statements without having the full benefit of public comment. And I am, you know, if my colleagues want more public comment, I'm happy to do that. We adopted a directive a couple of years ago that said we were going to get our drafts out a week in advance of the meeting. We almost never comply with that. I cannot resist pointing out this is the exact opposite of what was argued earlier, that we shouldn't come to the table with drafts already written. We should have a discussion at the table and figure out what we're going to do there in the public eye. You know, if we don't have drafts, we can't put them out for comment. So, you know, we got to have drafts. And, you know, I'm just a little bit, yeah, I'm happy to put it out for more comment and see if we get more comment. I'm a little bit frustrated on behalf of this requester. I was hoping we were going to be able to answer his question today because I thought we had a way of actually saying yes, which is usually a good answer for people. They like to generally hear yes, even if it's not, you know, the broadest possible yes or the yes that will also answer all of the commenters' questions or, you know, anybody else who might come along later. But hopefully we'll be able to give him an answer at some point.
Well, let's, Commissioner Hunter.
Okay, one last little point is, while I also think it's important to get comments on draft C, I am going to make another run at my colleagues to get a draft D. I'm not saying it's going to be successful, but I'm going to make a run. Thank you.
Oh, draft D, I can't wait.
Well, what we'll do is, once Mr. Elias hears back from his client, we'll move on to the next matter, and then we'll pick this one back up once that one's resolved. Okay. So thank you very much. So let's turn next to consideration of draft advisory opinion 2010-20, the National Defense PAC. We have, I understand we have Dan Backer on behalf of the requester here with us, and please join us at the council's table. And we have Bill Powers from the Office of General Counsel to give a presentation, and I guess it's gone from good morning to good afternoon. And when you're ready, please proceed.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Before you today are three agenda documents and advisory opinion requests, 2010-20 from the National Defense PAC, or NDPAC. The request asks if NDPAC, a non-connected committee, may raise unlimited contributions from individuals, corporations, other political committees, and labor organizations for the purpose of making independent expenditures, so long as it uses a separate account. The request also asks whether it may pay for administrative and operating expenses from either account as it sees fit. Agenda documents 10-60 and 10-60B, which are labeled Draft A and Revised Draft A, respectively, both conclude that NDPAC may not engage in the requested activity. Agenda documents 10-60-A, which is labeled as Draft B, reaches a different result and concludes that NDPAC may engage in its requested activity with certain limitations. In this request, we received one comment on the request itself, urging the commission to not grant NDPAC's request. We also received comments on the drafts urging the adoption of Draft B. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Discussion, excuse me, discussion or questions for requester? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be supporting revised Draft A in this matter, and just for public consumption, there's not a lot of distinction between Draft A and revised Draft A. There is a truncated answer as to question two to not get into the allocation question as deeply, because it is not necessary given the answer on one. I believe this draft best applies the existing statutory and regulatory provisions in light of recent court decisions. And in my view, CalMed is the controlling Supreme Court precedent here. It confirms that the governmental interest in preventing corruption is implicated by committees that make contributions, and NDPAC is such a committee. And the distinction between NDPAC and some of the prior, the more recent previous requesters like Common Sense 10 and Club for Growth is critical in my analysis of this question. And I think there's lots of discussion about the expanding what CU means and what Speech Now means, but in my view, those as we applied in the previous AOs of Common Sense and Club for Growth apply to independent expenditure only committees, and I am not willing to expand that analysis and that conclusion in this advisory opinion, where we have a different kind of requester that makes both contributions and independent expenditures, As I was rereading CalMed, as this is the important case here, I noted that even Justice Blackmun, who clearly had a sort of skeptical concurrence and in that result, noted that and frankly predicted that in a case of an independent expenditure only operation, these concerns might not be raised, but also noted that where a political committee becomes essentially conduits for contributions to candidates and as such poses a perceived threat of actual potential corruption. So accordingly, I'm persuaded that the Act and the existing regulatory provisions as applied and upheld by the Supreme Court require the answer in Draft A as revised. And, Mr. Chairman, at the appropriate time, I'll be able to make a motion to move that draft.
Thank you. Commissioner McGann.
This one's not easy. Where to begin? I had spent a lot of time on this one thinking through and trying to come through the analysis to get to the conclusion draft A reaches. And I had tried my own drafts on that front, and I couldn't get there. Because I actually went back and reread the case law. When you reread the case law, it's not as hard a question as I originally had thought. What is really at issue here are contribution limits. Contribution limits to candidates, that's the limit that matters, because that's where the corruption or appearance of corruption can occur. And the purpose of a contribution limit on a political committee that's not a campaign committee is to avoid circumvention of that limit, because someone could easily just give money to the candidate, then pass it through a political committee with that limit, and that would be something that would be illegal. But this requester, I think, realizes that and said, well, what we want to do is have two separate accounts. So we won't be just taking unlimited money and massaging it into campaign contributions. The limits are not going to be circumvented. They're going to have two separate accounts. And then I got hung up on the labeling. Because my one thought originally was, if you're a political committee, CalMed upheld limits on political committees that give contributions to candidates. This political committee is going to give contributions to candidates, so that kind of answers the question. If you take it at that kind of level, that's essentially the position that the commenter makes. He states these questions were answered by the U.S. Supreme Court and CalMed. Once I went back and reread CalMed, though, and its progeny, I respectfully disagree with that statement. I don't think CalMed went that far. On the contrary, CalMed expressly limited its holding, and it's not an easy case to read, because it's a four or five part opinion, and Justice Blackmun, who was the fifth vote for most of the opinion, did not join part three, which is really the meat of the opinion as to the limit, where he said he'll uphold the limit because of the giving contributions, but that's as far as I read him willing to go. So there were not five of nine Supreme Court justices to uphold the limit across the board. So to say that this is a political committee that makes contributions to candidates, therefore they're subject to a $5,000 limit on the money coming in, really doesn't get us to where we need to go, because that's not CalMed didn't go that far. If you don't believe me, the D.C. Circuit also says that in a case called Emily's List. Remarkably, the commenter does not reference Emily's List at all. And if I missed it, I apologize, but I've read the comment a bunch. And Draft A doesn't mention the Emily's List case. And this is FEC versus Emily's List, and it's a case the commission lost, and the D.C. Circuit had some things to say. But yet, it doesn't exist. And Emily's List really does answer this question that CalMed didn't reach. To me, political participants are not born political committees, right? That's sort of putting the cart before the horse. People decide what they're going to do, and then once they decide what they're going to do in politics, then they have to figure out, do they have to file reports with the government? Do they have to disclose? Are there contribution limits? What, you know, that sort of thing. But the notion of a political committee is not a pristine entity that is some sort of magic label that we can slap on something and then produce a contribution limit. The commission went down this road in MERS, most of which were due to around the 2004 election cycle, some were 2006, where in a way to limit independent spending, they tried to limit the money coming into an outside group by calling it a contribution limit. I we've written before on that, how that was really just a spending limit. Remarkably, a lot of the language in Emily's List seemed to take the same position and read the case law the same way I had read it before. But to me, to say that there's a contribution limit on NDPAC's account that is going to be used to make independent expenditures is nothing more than a spending limit, and runs wholly counter to every I would venture to say every case that's considered the issue. I have a few questions for the requester, but I'm not quite there yet, and I appreciate your patience and you being here. The difficulty with CalMed is illustrated really in draft A, footnote 3, where it says, in CalMed, the Supreme Court concluded that the Act properly prevented such circumvention of contribution limits. There's a nice quote there, which is footnote 19, which, of course, is in part 3 of the opinion, which is only 4 Supreme Court justices. That's actually not the court. That's a plurality of the court. Maybe that causes some of my colleagues pause to vote for that draft because it's not an accurate statement of what the Supreme Court did. But the question I have is actually the sentence from which footnote 3 springs, where it says, moreover, and this is actually going to be the commenter, page 7 of revised draft A says, beginning line 15, moreover, IndyPAC's request to support all of its activity, including the making of contributions to candidates using unlimited contributions from individuals, other political committees, corporations, and labor organizations, would result in the subsidization of its contributions to candidates and political parties and is therefore directly at odds with the Act's goal of preventing the circumvention of valid contribution limits. I'm not sure that's the Act's goal. I think the contribution limits are the goal in and of itself to avoid corruption appearance thereof. But I'm really teeing in on this, including the making of contributions to candidates using unlimited contributions for individuals, et cetera, et cetera. Two questions. First, I thought I saw somewhere in the correspondence between you and our counsel that you're not taking corporate money, or maybe you are. There was some question about that. If you could clarify that, I'd appreciate it. And two, I thought you were going to have a separate account with unlimited money, and you're not going to make contributions from that account. The only account you're going to use to make contributions is going to be limited with the money coming in. Is that? Yes. Okay.
To the first part, if our course of conduct is permitted, we would take corporate contributions, but okay. Not organizations that are chartered by federal act and other prohibited forms of corporate organizations.
Okay.
And separately, all contributions solicited and accepted for the purpose of making independent expenditures without the contribution limits will be in a separate account, which will not be part of any contributions made directly to candidates, which will come from a completely different account, which has funds solicited and accepted for that purpose only.
So when this draft says your request to support all of your activity, including the making of contributions to candidates using unlimited contributions, that's just not true.
Not technically. I think it refers to the point that in our original request we'd ask that we be allowed to allocate the cost of administrative and operating expenses, rent, fax machines, et cetera, as we saw fit. We defer to the language in draft B, which says that we should use the Emily's List language of a reasonably appropriate measure to that the distribution of or the allocation of costs for administrative expenses be proportioned to what the activity is.
Okay. And that gets into sort of the notion of an overhead ratio. The commission has tried to do that through reg a couple times, both of which haven't ended well for different reasons. The second time was to try to simplify the problems in the first time, and then, well, that didn't end so well in court, proving no good deed goes unpunished. But we can't allow hard money contributions to be subsidized impermissibly with soft money, because that would frustrate the contribution limit, and that's why the draft I support does say you do need to, if you are going to try to share costs, you do have to split those costs on some form to ensure the contribution limits are not frustrated. But for me, this Emily's List answers this question because it does, and two, as a practical matter, are we really going to tell this requester, no, they can't take unlimited money simply because they're a political committee, as the commission has viewed that term, really under the sort of old school way of viewing political committee. We're kind of in a new world here, and you have the idea of a political committee that can take unlimited money. The commission's agreed that that's okay. The commission really didn't have a choice. The courts have said that. But now we're in a little bit different situation to some. But really, if you have a political committee with two accounts, it seems to address the concerns raised by the courts, meaning we can't just disregard the contribution limit statute because it separates the money, so there can't be circumvention. the idea of separate accounts within one political group is well established in the law. Party committees do it all the time. National parties used to have all kinds of accounts. Congress didn't like that, so they changed it. But that doesn't mean that structure it doesn't still have some value in illustrating separate accounts. Would this requester then have to set up a separate political committee to do independent expenditures? I'm assuming we would all say that's okay. I don't want to put words in others' mouths, but I'm assuming based upon previous AOs that would be okay. But is that really the result that we want here? Because now you have two separate committees. If they do want to do shared costs, that gets very complicated. That's really where I got hung up. I couldn't figure out how to do it. And secondly, when it comes to reporting, you're really going to have two separate reports from two supposedly separate committees, which are really the same folks, or one person, two people. I have no idea who really who supports this political committee, and I don't think that really matters for the legal analysis. But you're going to have two separate political committees filing two sets of reports. When certainly folks can pool their money and do IEs without putting a contribution limit on that. Why not let that go through the same political committee so long as they maintain the separate accounts? The draft I support has some detailed guidance on reporting. It's the sort of thing that would be nice to have in the reg book, but we have to do what we can because you do have to file reports. And it seems to me the public would be better served by letting it flow through one political committee because it's all going to be on one report. If someone's coming to us and saying, we want a report, we want to be a political committee, we want to do this through a political committee, I think we ought to encourage that because it puts the reporting all in one place. The commenter doesn't really reach that issue, and it's something I thought of. It seems that the result urged by the commenter pushes the money into different places, pushes it into different reports, ends up being confusing, I think, certainly be confusing to me. So for me, once I thought this through, although I was intrigued by the notion that, well, it's a political committee, so we have to have a $5,000 limit because they give money to candidates. If they do the separate accounts, it becomes a distinction without a difference if it's within one political committee or two separate political committees. So then I landed on it should be in one political committee because that's the way to have the public have the information in one place as opposed to have to find two different committees and figure out how they're associated or not associated, affiliated or not affiliated. That's a term of art. So for me, I land where I land because I don't think CalMed reaches the question. I think Emily's list did. I don't think we really have much of a choice in the matter, but we can't let the tail wag the dog. Political committees don't just happen. There are people wanting to do things, and then they decide, based upon what they're doing, what legal obligations they have with respect to reporting and that sort of thing. What a political committee is or isn't, I think we have to seriously consider long term and rethink some of the fundamental premises because many of them have changed. Commissioner Walter, if he were here, would say we shouldn't do this in an AO, but these folks want to do ads today, and they want the protection of an AO. I think they have the protection of the case law, but as we know in past, that doesn't always give you protection until you get back to court. So you really don't want to deal with, the FEC enforcement process. The courts haven't been kind in their descriptions of that. So to me, this is not opening up something weird. It's a more pro-disclosure way of doing it, so long as they maintain the two separate accounts. Emily's list talks about accounts. They don't talk about separate political committees. And I hope we don't just get hung up on the labels. Political committee is a term of art. Account is not. But to me, in where we are today, it becomes a distinction without a difference. So for that reason, I can't support the draft A. I don't think it reflects current law, and I think it potentially makes a mess of the our reporting regime in a way that I don't think is anticipated. But so I hope maybe given the fact that there's a statement in there that doesn't really seem accurate, they're not going to make contributions from unlimited funds coming in, coupled with the fact that maybe the disclosure aspect would cause folks to rethink their position. But I can't support that draft. I support the other draft B. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad that the requester understood draft A, even if my colleague didn't. I agree with everything that Commissioner Bowerly said. I believe that CalMed controls. Emily's List is a circuit court opinion. It contains a great deal of dicta. It concerned our allocation regulations, which is not what this requester is asking about. I had hoped that we could seek a hearing on bank and get better clarity from the D.C. Circuit, since we had an opinion from two judges and one of from three judges, but one of them filed a concurring statement saying, you know, you two are like going all over the place. I don't know what you're doing. In any event, the D.C. Circuit cannot overrule the Supreme Court. The binding precedent is from the Supreme Court in CalMed. We didn't force these guys to be a political committee. They willingly and appropriately registered as a political committee with us some time ago. I haven't checked, but to the best of my knowledge, they've been complying with the disclosure regime in all that time. I assume that they're dutifully filing their reports and meeting their disclosure obligations. If they or anybody else sets up an independent-only expenditure committee, as the Speech Now Court seemed to anticipate, and as we talked about in a couple of other AOs, as I have stated before, and I didn't think my colleague disagreed with me on this, an independent expenditure-only committee should also register as a political committee because they, by definition, are only engaged in making express advocacy communications, and I don't see how, you know, assuming that they raise or spend $1,000 to do that, I don't see what the conceivable argument would be that they wouldn't register. And, of course, we have rules on identifying political committees and making sure that their names accurately disclose who they are. So I don't think there'd be any confusion in the public as to whether who was supporting this independent committee should they choose to do that. Now, it's not for me to tell them what to do or whether they should do that. That's, of course, up to the requester. But what they've asked is, can they just set up separate bank accounts? That is not something that the courts have so far endorsed or mandated. And, you know, Speech Now speaks specifically to independent expenditure-only committees. CalMed, critical Blackmun concurrence, which, and by the way, I did reread the entire opinion last night. You're not the only one who reads court cases, Commissioner. Justice Blackmun stressed that this analysis suggests that a different result would follow if 441AA1C were applied to contributions to a political committee established for the purpose of making independent expenditures. That's what he was fixated on. It's a line that I've heard you quote many times, so I know you're well familiar with it. You know, the law is changing in this area. Maybe this is the shape of things to come. Maybe at some point this will be where the law goes, but I don't think the law is there yet today. I don't think any courts have told us that we have to go there today. I think that, to the contrary, the courts have told us not to go here. They may change their minds in the future. And I'm personally not prepared to extend the principles from other court cases that concern different kinds of entities to what this requester is requesting. So I am on revised draft A with my colleague Vice Chair Bowerly, and I don't normally speak about other commissioners, particularly when they're not in the room, but since you have said that you thought Commissioner Walther would probably say we can't answer this, we have to issue a regulation, my conversations with him indicate that he was fully prepared to say no today. So I didn't want to leave that misperception out there that maybe there was some other alternative that has not been put forward to the public in the form of a draft that any commissioner has, at least so far, voiced support for.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it's I certainly was not trying to guess where Commissioner Walther would be. I don't think it's a misperception. He had, in a previous AO, in a similar topic, had indicated that he thought rulemaking was the way to go, and that position certainly has some merit, but we're confronted with folks here today. To say that Emily's List only concerned overhead ratio and that's not what we have here today, I think is just not accurate, because it really is the flip side of the same coin, because at the end of the day it's imposing a contribution limit on spending that is not something that we can regulate. because in Emily's list, the issue was this overhead ratio where the FEC mandated that any sort of shared cost had to be picked up with at least 50% hard money, and the Emily's list court said that goes too far because you're essentially imposing a hard money requirement on activity that for which there is no basis to impose a hard money requirement. That is precisely the same thing Draft A does here, where you're essentially imposing a hard money requirement on activity that every court that's looked at this says is not something that we can impose such a hard money requirement on. To sort of poo-poo Emily's list and say there was this concurrence that sort of, you know, said the majority didn't know what they were doing and all this, that's simply not true. I mean, the Emily's list opinion certainly has all kinds of things in there, all of which I think are necessary to reach the result. And we don't need to really re-debate Emily's list unless someone wants to. I'm certainly willing to do that. But you know, not only did Emily's list say constitutional problems, but that the FEC was going beyond its statutory authority, and all three judges agreed with that. And that was really the point of the concurrence, was that the majority really didn't have to reach the constitutional issue. Of course, to avoid the constitutional issue under DiBartolo and its progeny, you have to reach it and then read the statute to avoid it. But that's why the majority opinion, I think, was sound in that respect. But all the concurrence was doing was saying that the FEC was beyond its statutory ground to try to impose what was essentially a limit on spending that the FEC had no business imposing such a limit upon. And reading that concurrence, I mean, it really is, it's deja vu all over again, right? Quoting the concurrence, by the plain language of the Federal Election Campaign Act, the FEC lacks the power it now asserts. Seems like that applies here as well. Here, the FEC has set aside Congress's command that the agency's jurisdiction be bounded by the quote-unquote purpose for which the money is spent. That's a critical phrase, because here the money in question is going to be spent on independent expenditures. We know that doesn't have a limit on the spending side. We now know that that's not limited on the contribution side. But I guess we don't, because now it seems like we are going to impose a contribution limit on that. If one were to make the argument that in order to ensure that the contribution limit to candidates is not circumvented, and or there will not be corruption or the appearance there, or there will be corruption or appearance thereof if we don't impose a limit on the PAC, I can hear that argument. That makes some sense to me. I think it goes too far, but that's at least an issue that I think folks can debate, meaning, because they don't have a limit, maybe there's a perception that there's extra help here, or there'll be an appearance. Citizens United Court really rejected that sort of access and appearance kind of thing. It really has to be a much tighter fit. The other part of the concurrence in Emily's list had a lot of rhetoric basically saying how McConnell was wrong and, quote, McConnell's careless invocation of access and influence are synonyms for corruption is instructive. Of course, that's been the way I read Citizens United, let's say, clarified. But if we were having a debate over the justification for the limit, and I think we have to, because when the courts limit the reach of a statute, we have to be mindful of that, and we have to realize why, where the limitation is, and it's going to be driven by the basis for the statute, which is corruption or appearance thereof. And if I could see if we're having a discussion over whether or not unlimited money into the same political committee causes a problem. We're not having that discussion. We're citing CalMed for the proposition that this is an open and shut case, citing for a plurality, not the majority. There's not a lot of room here to really have a meaningful discussion on where we're going. And my concern is for the future. I thought when these cases came down, we could wipe the slate clean and readjust our first principles and really get into the nitty-gritty of a lot of these new issues. But if this is where we are, this doesn't really bode well for the future, because essentially we're saying Emily's list doesn't exist. It does. It's Emily's List versus Federal Election Commission's D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. We're in the D.C. Circuit. We lost the case. Some may not like the case, but it's a case and it's binding on the agency. And if we don't recognize it as having some sort of effect on what we do, we're in for a long haul down the road on how we're gonna craft. modify, craft, repeal, and otherwise clean up current regs that are affected by recent case law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to move this along, I support draft B. I don't think that CalMed directly speaks to the scenario that's set forth by the requester in this situation. I do think that the Emily's List case does, and talking about how describing an entity just like the Andy PAC as a when it discusses hybrid nonprofit entities and their ability to establish both hard money and soft money accounts. I think that that speaks directly to the request, and as a result, I think that that the structure that requester would like to put in place, where there would be both a hard money account that would be fully subject to the limits, prohibitions, and reporting requirements of the Act, and then have a separate account that out of which the PAC would only be making independent expenditures. I think that that is, again, not only consistent with Emily's List, but it certainly is consistent, I think, with recent precedent that we've been seeing along this line in Citizens United and in Speech Now. So I'm prepared to support Draft B. And any further discussion? If none, do we have a motion? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move adoption of Agenda Document 10-60B, which is revised Draft A in Advisory Opinion 10-20 National Defense PAC.
All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? No. The motion fails by a vote of 2-3 with Commissioner Weintraub and the Vice Chair in favor, and Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself opposed. Do we have a further motion? Commissioner Hunter.
I move adoption of Agenda Document 10-60-A, which is Draft B of this advisory opinion. Thank you.
Okay. All those in favor of this motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion fails by a vote of 3-2 with Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself in favor, and Commissioners Weintraub and the Vice Chair opposed. At this point, would instruct counsel to send the appropriate letter to requester indicating that the commission could not answer this, provide them an answer to their request. Mr. Backer, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We will, if we still have Mr. Elias and Mr. Burkhan here, we will double back to consideration of the Google AO.
I'm still just awaiting an answer, so perhaps I should just follow up with the staff when it comes in. Obviously, the company's on the West Coast and trying to get it resolved.
Okay. Well, what we'll do is we'll hold this one over, and pending the answer from your client, we'll make the appropriate course correction as necessary once we hear back from you, Mr. Elias.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Palmer, do we have any management or administrative matters to discuss?
Mr. Chairman, there are none.
All right. Meeting is adjourned.